Hello and welcome to the Blockade Runner podcast number 261. My name is John. Joining me today is Ryan. What's up, Ryan?
Good morning. Hello.
Yeah, so we are back a little tardy, I suppose. We're back to talk about the Acolyte trailer, which dropped, I don't know, I guess early this week, Monday, right? Was it Monday?
I think it was last week.
Oh, last week. See, that's how tardy we are. Yeah, it was last week. Yeah, last week. Maybe last Monday or Tuesday. It was pretty early in the week last week. So anyway, this trailer has been out. It's been percolating for a while now. And we're gonna dig into it, and also some comments and some information about the show that has come out along with the trailer. So we'll kick off with discussing the trailer here in just a second. The show is coming out on June 4th, which we also learned, and that's good. That's exciting. I think one of the last times we were recording, we were talking about, you know, how all of these Disney Plus shows were maybe going to fit into the schedule coming up here, and I'm happy to see that Acolyte is early in the year, and that leaves room for maybe Skeleton Crew later on.
Yeah.
Okay. So June 4th, Ryan, I don't have the poster pulled up, but I know you were a pretty big fan of the poster that released along with the show as well.
Yeah, they put out a teaser poster the day before the trailer, and it's pretty sick. Basically there's a lightsaber on it, and you see like something red coming out of the top, and you're like, oh, it's a red lightsaber, it's, you know, a Sith blade, whatever. But then you look closer and it's actually blood. And then the text reads, "In an age of light, a darkness rises." And that's where we got the June 4th date, and then the next day we got the trailer.
Yeah. So that is pretty sweet. It's pretty hardcore. It's pretty metal, the bloody lightsaber there. In an age of light, a darkness rises. And then there was a second poster also. The one that you just described is the one I was talking about. So that was the one that, as you said, was posted the day before the trailer, announcing the trailer and the release date and all that. There's also another poster. I'm going to try to, not great audio, but I'm going to try to present it. Let's see. For the video here, I don't know, is that, there it is. Yeah. So this is a pretty sweet poster as well. This one maybe more of a, I don't know. I think this one feels like more of a, they would put it up around town. You know, I mean, it's not going to be in movie theaters, I guess, but like I have the, I haven't framed it yet and put it up, but I have the, an Obi-Wan Kenobi, kind of teaser poster that maybe looks a little more like this, you know? So, yeah, both cool posters. This one just kind of beautiful photography. Do we know the name of this character, Ryan?
This is, I don't know if we know her character. This is Amandla Stenberg's character,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember if we know the name of the character.
Well, you know, one way to find out, and maybe I can do a little research here as we go, there's some Black Series toys on the way, from the Acolyte. And, there is one of this character. I know it is like titled, the Assassin. The toy is called, like the Assassin, but I think it's one of those things where, I think it's one of those things where they kind of give it like, oh, Luke Skywalker, Tatooine, or Luke Skywalker, you know? So, yeah, character's name is May, I believe. MAE. So, okay. Yeah. Because there's a Black Series toy, and I don't know what... I'm looking at the Malaysian site. I don't know why, but I'm looking at the Malaysian version of the the Hasbro Pulse site, and the May figure is 124 Malaysian dollars, I guess. I'm not sure what the currency is there, but...
So probably, what, like 30, 40 bucks, whatever Black Series figures cost here now?
Yeah, they're like 25 bucks, I guess, right? Something like that. So the standard ones are 25, I think. And then if they throw in like an extra hat or something, then they're like closer to 35 or 40. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, what were your impressions of the trailer, Ryan?
You know, I watched it, you know, a few times, of course. I think the first time it's like, it's always hard with Star Wars trailers. You're like trying to take everything in. You're, you know, trying to figure out like what's happening in the story, but also like, what is the, you know, how is this from like an aesthetic and artistic standpoint as well? Is this what I want Star Wars to look like? Is this what I think Star Wars should look like? You know, you're running through all those questions in your head. And I think like, the first time I watched it, you know, I was interested and there was like a bunch of stuff I liked, but there was also this, oh, this is, you know, this is just gonna kind of look like a Star Wars show on Disney Plus. Like, you know, it's gonna look like, you know, Obi-Wan or Ahsoka. Like, it's just gonna have that kind of like, you know, if you pulled like one screenshot out, like you could trick someone into thinking it's a fan film kind of thing. Because it doesn't have that, you know, real filmic cinematic look to it. And so like that was kind of disappointing initially. But then, you know, with like Obi-Wan and Ahsoka, like I don't think those look as good as a Star Wars, you know, film or even something like Andor. But, you know, there's still shows that I really like. And, you know, there's other things to like about them, and like the story, the characters, the acting, like everything. And so then, you know, after I kind of got over that hump, then it was kind of like, okay, well, let's see what's like actually here and what there is to unpack from this. And then, yeah, like I'm obviously very stoked for this show. What about you? What were your initial thoughts?
Well, I just want to, you know, I don't want to immediately argue with you, Ryan. I don't want to be contradictory or, you know, kind of shoot down.
What we do.
It's not that I don't think your opinion here is valid, but, you know, you said, hey, it looks like a TV show and it doesn't look quite as cool as I hoped it would. And I mean, the very first image of this trailer, I feel, is arguing back at you, because look at this dude. Look at this, like, this youngling who is a youngling yet looks like maybe he's, you know, 1,000 years old and has a big, you know, red beard that envelops his entire head. You know, yeah. Like he's awesome.
He's a race from what movie is this? Is this race in?
I don't know.
This alien dude. Yeah, like he's from one of the new movies.
But he's a baby race version.
Yeah.
He's a youngling version.
Yeah.
No, you're right. He's in the Force. This guy, I believe, is in the Force Awakens and probably other sequel trilogy movies too.
Yeah.
But not this guy. I mean, like this guy's species, right?
Maybe he grows up to be in the Force Awakens. Maybe
We can only hope that someday we'll learn, oh, it was the same guy. Like, it's the same dude. Like, yes.
We need to have everything explained to us.
That's my favorite thing in Star Wars, when it turns out, like, oh, that's the same guy. Like, it's in the same...
Yeah, this, like, completely random, like, just created by, like, a costumer or, artist that has nothing to do with the story. Let's really explore their backstory connect it to everything. Yeah, love when Star Wars does that.
No. My overall impressions of the trailer are probably similar to yours. I wouldn't say I was disappointed with the look of it, but I think I was surprised by the look of it. And the poster the day before is part of that, because the poster the day before is like a darkness rises and there's freaking blood. Like, it was seemed so dark. And then watching this, it was like, it felt much more like what Star Wars usually feels like, you know? So I think you were describing that in terms of the visuals. It looks like a Star Wars Disney Plus show, and it just doesn't, from this trailer, it doesn't feel that different. But you know, my expectations are still pretty high, and I wouldn't say disappointed is the right word. I think I was just a little surprised by the way it looked, and not even necessarily just the way or totally the way it looked, because I don't really have a problem. I think it looks good, but maybe just like the tone and just like what footage I saw and what footage they chose to build the trailer around. I was kind of expecting it to come out swinging like, you know, hey, this is a little darker, this is a little heavier, this is a little more metal, this is a little more goth, you know what I mean, or whatever. And I'm not disappointed that it's not those things. Mm-hmm. I just think that's what I was kind of had in my head as an expectation, is what that trailer was going to kind of look like, you know?
Yeah, I think like the posters are a really good place to start. I hadn't actually seen the second one that you showed. That's just like, you know, the character standing in a desert, and it's, you know, there's either a sunrise or a sunset happening there, and it's just kind of like orange, and you know, you're like, it looks like, you know, the Dune poster, it looks like the Obi-Wan poster, it, you know, just looks like a thing that gets made in 2024. And whereas like the first poster was like really bold and you know, challenging, and like really got your mind racing. And I think that's kind of what I was like hoping for from the trailer, is something like, you know, just really like bold and, you know, potentially uncomfortable, you know, something to really be like, wait, you can do this in Star Wars kind of thing. Like, you know, but what we kind of got was, you know, just like, yeah, this is, you know, a Disney Plus Star Wars show. It's kind of like, you know, it reminds me of a lot of like the struggle I had with the MCU before I fully bailed on it, where I'd like, they'd be like, yeah, this is going to, you know, shake everything up. Like, this is like an auteur vision of the MCU. Like, this is going to, you know, really challenge people. And there's like really compelling like marketing and stuff. And then you go and like see the movie or whatever, and you're like, oh, that's just like a, you know, MCU house style.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, oh, that's exactly the same formula that is in 32 other of these movies. Like, I've seen this movie 32 times. Like, and I wouldn't, like, I still think this show is going to be more than that. And, you know, even in, like, the interviews, and there's stuff that, Leslie Headland says that's like, she didn't make this trailer. Like, this was the trailer that was given to her by, you know, Disney and Lucasfilm. And like, she's like, yeah, I like it. But the stuff that she says in the interview, I don't think is reflected in this trailer or reflected in the type of work that she does. And I'm really hoping that this isn't a, you know, kind of the MCU situation where they like bring in these like auteur, bold, visionary directors, and then completely saw off every rough edge to just make it, like, you know, this very formulaic thing. I hope that's not the case. And I think, you know, we have stuff like The Last Jedi and Andor to be like, no, you can still get, like, a very, you know, big vision in a Star Wars story these days. And I hope that that is the case, but, like,
I would even here, I would even argue Mandalorian. Mandalorian feels exceedingly Jon Favreau to me, and Ahsoka feels very, very Dave Filoni to me, too. You know what I mean? I don't know enough about Deborah Chow to say, like, Obi-Wan Kenobi feels so Deborah Chow, but, like, I feel like I see their voices and their kind of authorship in those shows, too. You know, as much as they're not, I don't think they're, like, challenging in the way that, you know, The Last Jedi or Andor are.
Yeah.
But I just think, like, I don't watch those shows and think, oh, man, like, Filoni and Favreau, they really wanted to, like, go in these bold directions and, like, you know, they were told not to. I think, like, no, Ahsoka feels like Filoni as hell. You know what I mean?
He goes,
and,
yeah, he goes yeah, full Filoni.
Yeah, and so, I think it's, I think it's true of Mandalorian, too. So, yeah.
I mean, I guess Book of Boba Fett is pretty.
Actually,
Robert
that's true,
Rodriguez
too. That,
at the end of the day.
That speeder race in the back lot, like, all that stuff, like, that's major, Rodriguez stuff there, too. Yeah. So,
okay. Now, yeah. I guess that makes me feel a little bit better. But I don't feel like, if we're just talking about the trailer,
yeah,
I don't feel like that fully comes through in the trailer.
I agree. I like the trailer. I think the show is going to be awesome.
Yes.
I think I'm so convinced the show is going to be awesome that my expectations for the trailer were pretty high. And it might have been a little underwhelming, but, you know, I think that's partially, like, me building it up so much. And like you said, maybe only giving us a little glimpse of what the show has in store for us, too. So,
yeah. Well, let's actually talk about the trailer, because there's, like, tons of cool stuff.
Yeah, let's watch it. Let's watch it.
Yeah.
Close your eyes. Your eyes can deceive you. We must not trust them. Tell me what comes into your mind.
Life. Balance. I see fire.
Someone is killing Jedi. It doesn't make sense.
What happened?
I sensed darkness.
This isn't about good or bad. This is about power and who is allowed to use it.
What is that?
Well, we've got a Jedi Master here talking to these little younglings, telling them to close their eyes and trust their feelings.
Your eyes can deceive you.
What comes
good
to mind?
Star Wars lesson right there. Very Star Wars.
Yeah.
And then, like, what do you see? Someone says, I see fire.
Yeah, life balance, and then I see fire, the last youngling says, right? Yeah. So, you know, that's the first 35 seconds or so, and I don't want to be, like, laborious, like, every, you know, shot necessarily to go through, but, like, let's talk about the Jedi, what we call it, the Jedi Temple, I guess, the Jedi Temple area, where the younglings are.
It seems.
Yeah. I mean, it feels pretty prequely, right? It feels like...
Yeah.
it looks pretty prequely, I guess you'd say, mm-hmm. in a good way.
Yeah.
For us, right? The younglings are.
I feel like this is like one of those things where it's sometimes hard for me to appreciate things in Star Wars like this, because, you know, obviously we're huge prequel fans. We love, you know, seeing stuff like this, Jedi Temple on Coruscant, like that's awesome. I feel like they've gone back to this well a few times in the last few years. So like the impact is a little bit reduced here.
Yeah. How about the robes on the Jedi Master though? I believe his name is Sol, S-O-L, which you may know means sun in other languages, but I believe his name is Sol, S-O-L. The robes are like major High Republic. I feel like it has the High Republic.
Light.
Yeah. Light.
Yeah. And this is something that, Leslie Headland talks about in one of the interviews that I read, where it's like, yeah, they're all wearing, like, for the most part, they're wearing light colored robes because this is a time where the Jedi don't really need to ever get their hands dirty.
Interesting. Okay. All right, right on. And then, I guess in this initial section too, there's footage of this assassin character in the purple robes, kind of making her way through various settings. We've got a very traditional Star Wars cantina with an interesting alien in the middle there, sucking up some noodles out of a bowl. Mm-hmm. So we've got Neil Scanlan creature shop, up and running and mm-hmm. with some nice practical, creatures there. And then like where we left off, we, kind of zoom in here on Carrie Ann Moss's character, right?
Mm-hmm. Which is very cool to see.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, all right. Well, let's watch a little more. Okay, so you get a little bit of a battle between Carrie Ann Moss and the assassin character with the kind of reveal shot of the assassin there. I believe one of the things we've heard about this show is that one of the influences are like martial arts films, right?
Mm-hmm.
So definitely seeing some of that in the hand-to-hand combat there. Kind of cool to see a Jedi doing the hand-to-hand thing, no lightsaber, and uses the force push there. So that's a pretty cool sequence.
Yeah. They specifically, the martial arts films are the wuxia genre, which is like Chinese Hong Kong style of films that, you know, really kind of came into their own in the 70s, and then like obviously people have iterated on them a lot. The Wachowskis brought in a lot of wuxia influences into The Matrix. And so, you know, seeing Carrie Ann Moss and having, you know, this kind of like, grounded, but probably eventually some wired, martial arts happening, makes me very happy, because as I'm a fan of all that stuff too, including The Matrix. So.
Right on. Yeah, that sounds cool. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that, just because it feels like something that Star Wars hasn't really drawn from very much. So that'll be mm-hmm. A new flavor, I think, which should be good. Should be good.
Yeah. Yeah.
And definitely this character, I mean, looks pretty striking. The one thing I'll say though, is like, she kind of looks like she's wearing a mask, like a COVID mask, in this shot a little bit, you know, like, I'm just like, oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Pandemic. Like we were doing that. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm sure, like, seeing it more in practice in the show or whatever in context, it probably won't look quite so much like that. But And you know, I think that's probably not the intention or not the reason for the look, but that's like the first thing I think, of course. So yeah, this June, someone is killing Jedi. It doesn't make sense. We hear from one of these Jedi Knights, I assume. That feels like a High Republic thing right there for sure, doesn't it? Like,
yep. And we had, you know, a High Republic miniseries that was like a hard-boiled detective noir comic series. And, you know, that's something that's a huge, you know, that's like the basic plot of this series, at least, you know, according to the interviews, is that this is a murder mystery.
Yeah.
Which, again, is like another kind of like thing to differentiate it from other Star Wars things. But what's really funny is Leslie Headland talks about Rashomon, which you know, is a classic samurai film, for, you know, not just the story and the action, but how the story is told, which is like getting the story like in bits and pieces from different perspectives at different times, which also obviously was a huge influence on the Luke and Ben stuff in The Last Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
And this will not be the only time we mention Rian Johnson in all this, but yeah, we can continue.
Yeah. And I just thought too, like High Republic, because, you know, early on it's like, oh, well, something is, I've read all of phase one, or like, you know, the major works in phase one. And, I've read, I guess, one, like the main novel from phase two. So I'm not completely caught up on High Republic. I have, well, that's an understatement. There's a lot of High Republic I haven't read, yeah, but I've been trying, you know, and I've been reading some of it. And, you know, the attitude, I think, is just of the Jedi, especially initially, is just sort of that, like, oh, well, nobody can kill a Jedi, or, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, no, it can't be. There can't be anyone singling us out. That must be, you know, that's a mistake or whatever. So obviously this would be after all of that, but after the Nile and everything. But yeah, it just kind of seems to be that similar sort of attitude, you know, from the Jedi. So feels like that fits with the High Republic era.
Yeah, and, you know, to quote Anakin Skywalker, no one can kill a Jedi, right?
Mm, I wish that were true. I wish that were so. All right, let's keep going here. That's from the trailer, or from the poster, right, in an age of light, darkness rises. And we see more footage of the assassin character battling Carrie Ann Moss's character, and also the Jedi Master from the beginning of the trailer there, who was with the younglings. Plus, we saw the Wookiee Jedi, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah.
This isn't about good or bad. This is about power and who's allowed to use it, which is pretty intriguing, right?
That's a really good, really good line.
Yeah.
That's compelling stuff.
I wonder who that character is who states that. She looks like she's maybe in this snowy area. I don't know, maybe not, but she's, I don't know, seems to be like a queen or something, maybe. Like, she has...
definitely has some, like, followers.
Yeah, they look like handmaidens almost.
Yeah.
You know?
She's wearing, like, royal-ish garb. Yeah.
Yes, and of course, purple, a color associated with nobility as well, so... Maybe that's what we have going on. But then that's also the same color that the assassin character is wearing. So I don't know if that's intentional or not. This almost looks like Octo. I'm sure it's not, but boy, does that look like Octo.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, some really a really striking shot of the assassin character there.
Oh God, I just realized that we're going to have to deal with location discourse again.
Oh yeah,
because there's a snowy planet or like snowy scenes, mm-hmm. So they'll be the why isn't this just Hoth,
or why isn't
it is Hoth, why is it Hoth? And then here we have this like island thing, and it's gonna be like, why is this on Octo, or why didn't they just use Octo?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah,
I look forward to.
Yeah. And then we have this final scene, red lightsaber, kind of helicoptering through the, not helicoptering like a Star Wars Rebels Inquisitor, but helicoptering like being thrown through the woods,
spinning,
yeah,
through some trees,
yep, and some fear on the faces of those Jedi Knights, and then. We see a whole line, like a whole, what do you call that in a strategy game when you got people all lined up like that, you know?
A front line? Line of defense?
Something like that, yeah. A whole group of Jedi there lined up, couple green lightsabers, two yellow lightsabers, and a blue lightsaber. Only one blue lightsaber for me, but still, that's cool. You know, kind of going into battle against this force, right? And then there's like a shockwave, like red, is even red smoke, red dirt, dust, I don't know what, but like that pushes all of them back at once. So that's seems to be pretty powerful, you know, source of evil there, I guess.
Yeah, I think like this, what's happening in this scene is really cool. I think when they show them all lined up with the lightsabers powering on, I think that's one of those shots that does feel a little fan filmy to me.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm sure it's like fine in context, but I think it's, I don't know. It's not my favorite thing about.
Well, you probably know that, Ryan, you specifically probably know that I, in general, don't love the concept of a whole mess of Jedi all battling together with all their lightsabers everywhere. And it calls to mind the end of Attack of the Clones, which, you know, I don't hate, but it's like not my favorite. And part of the reason is I think an overwhelming number of Jedi is not very interesting, and I don't think it looks cool, you know, et cetera. And I just think that, you know, we've only seen a snippet here, but I think this looks much, that's much less of a problem for me here than in something like the end of Attack of the Clones, because there's like seven or eight of them maybe, you know, which is to me not nearly as bad as like 50 or I don't know how many hundreds there are in Attack of the Clones, but which is not to say too that we won't get scenes or sequences in this show where there's quite a few Jedi like that. And if so, you know, that's fine. But I was worried, not worried, but I guess like when I first saw the trailer, I was like, ooh, okay, so it's a bunch of Jedi. And then also, you know, we had a term that we coined at one point. I don't remember how we did it. Jedi Dans, you know, just look like a bunch of Dans, like a bunch of dudes named Dan in robes, bathrobes, you know. They don't look like Jedi.
It's like walking the floor at Celebration.
Like, yes.
You just, yep.
And there, in my opinion, there are a number of shots in Attack of the Clones that look that way, where it's just like, these are just some random dudes. They threw robes on them. They don't look like Jedi. They don't look like actors or characters. They just look like extras in robes, and it's not, that to me doesn't do much for the mystique of the Jedi, personally. Anyway, long story short, what I'm trying to say is that I don't really have that problem with this trailer at all. Even this shot or these shots of them all lined up like this, I still think it looks cool. I still think they look like distinct individuals. I still think it's not overwhelming to me, and it never gets to the point, for me anyways, of looking generic yet. So I'm happy about that.
It's walking a line, though.
Yeah, I could. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So, but we'll see. I mean, you know, if this is like the highest number of Jedi that are on screen together, and you know, like it's a little crew of 8 or 10, you know, Jedi together or whatever, I bet they'll be able to navigate that pretty well. So.
Yeah. But, so I think this gets into like one of my big questions about this show is like this scene in particular definitely seems like some Sith stuff. You know, you have this super powerful entity that has a red lightsaber, throws it, and then like uses like a super force push with a bunch of like red dust, which is like, I mean, extremely Sith. It's very Sith. And so, you know, maybe there's, you know, maybe things are not as they seem, which is possible. But I think if we get to the point where it's like, yeah, this is, they're Sith killing Jedi, like that's what's happening in this show, then I think it gets tricky to reconcile some stuff in the prequels, like when they talk about like how, you know, how there haven't been Sith in so long, and you know, that's obviously something I'm sure they're thinking through, but I don't know. We're just like in a weird place where they have to kind of make those things align. And I think, you know, it's very possible to just be like, you know, at the end of the show, they're like, this knowledge needs to be hidden forever, and it's going to be tucked away like the Ark of the Covenant, and no one will ever know. And that's why they don't know in episode one, but I don't know. That's feels like a tricky spot to navigate.
Yeah, I do think that's tricky. It's interesting because with the, I guess, post, I don't know, what would you call it? Post Clone Wars, post, post prequel trilogy. I don't know, like just basically Star Wars once. Yeah, basically Star Wars after Revenge of the Sith came out. I think even when George was still there, he was like, okay, well, we're done with the Skywalker saga, but we still definitely want to have some lightsaber action and characters in cartoons and, you know, other mediums and media. Yeah, mediums. So, like, we'll have Sith-esque characters, you know, and Jedi-esque characters, but they're not really Jedi and they're not really Sith until eventually they pretty much were just like, oh, okay, I guess there's a bunch of Jedi left still. And, you know, like, we can definitely uncover a new Jedi every time we turn the corner. And, you know what I mean? It just sort of, because it's not much different than, you know, you're our only hope. Oh, though there's another, you know, whatever. But like now we know that at the time that Yoda and Obi-Wan were saying stuff like that in the original trilogy, there was actually probably California Kestis and Ahsoka and Ezra and Sabine. And you know what I mean? Like every time you turn around, there's a new character that actually was alive, but they were over here doing a different thing or something. You know what I mean? And so I just think that it in this era, those sacred cows aren't that sacred anymore, it feels like, you know. So that's one thing I would say. And then the other thing I would say is that I guess, you know, it kind of depends on the way the Jedi organization is kind of set up too, I suppose, you know, like how. Yeah, I don't know. Well, I guess that doesn't really matter because it's like, well, if this little group of Jedi are out hunting this, you know, dark presence or whatever, and they confront it, but they don't make it back, then maybe the Jedi don't find out as a larger organization. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mace Windu never gets the memo.
Yeah. And then I guess, you know, kind of one other thing is that I feel like the show is going to be about either Darth Plagueis or Darth Sidious. Well, it can't be really Darth Sidious, but like, so maybe like Darth Plagueis, or I feel like whatever Sith comes before Palpatine, whether it's a generation removed or two generation removed, they're going to pop up, right, in the show. They have, I don't have to, but I feel like that's got to be very likely what we're going to see. Because if we're going to maintain, you know, from the prequels, always two there are, no more, no, you know, no less, whatever, then, I mean, what are we seeing if not an acolyte of one of those Sith?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I guess that is like I guess that's unexplored territory.
In canon?
I'm just trying to think. Like, there was probably like a Darth Plagueis book in the EU.
There was by James Luceno. Yes.
Okay.
I haven't read it, but there was by James Luceno, but you know, that was definitely pre-canon reset or whatever we call it. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's much of anything on the books regarding that stuff. But, you know, otherwise, if it's not about that, then I think that you don't have to worry, because it would be kind of what I was describing earlier, which is red lightsabers and evildoers, but they're not technically Sith. So then Yoda and Mace Windu can sit around and talk about how, yeah, we haven't seen them. Or Ki-Adi-Mundi can talk about how we haven't seen the Sith for a millennia or whatever, you know. But I think your initial quandary is logical, and that mm-hmm. we are going to see Sith in this show. And so the question is, you know, how much of what we see gets back to the Jedi, or how much knowledge of that does the Jedi institution retain going into the prequels? Or is Ki-Adi-Mundi just like straight up lying to Obi-Wan? Is it like, well, you know, what would Tom DeLonge say about this? You know what I mean? Like, is it that aliens are out there and, you know, top level people know all about it, but they're just not going to tell us about it? You know what I mean? And it's a need to know basis kind of thing. Perhaps it's something like that.
Yeah, but then that like totally changes the story of the prequels. Like, if the council actually knows there are Sith,
yeah,
then like a ton of things like don't work.
Yeah, that'd be kind of bad. That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. I hope it's handled in a way that doesn't feel like, oh, well, you're just going to say that they, you know, they covered it up.
Well, we know Leslie Hendlin is a major prequel kid, right? So the respect has to be there. So I'm sure as much as we're considering this, she has considered it a lot more. And I'll try to maintain faith that it's going to be handled well, and I assume it will be.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
You know, like I'm sure the story group has seen the prequels once or twice. Like, if anything, like, majorly contradicts, though.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Probably be able to call it out. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's look at these quotes that you pulled from Leslie Hendlin in the last week or two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, she first, I think, like, one thing that's, you know, just really nice to hear, you know, as a big Rian Johnson fan, a big Last Jedi fan. She had worked with Rian Johnson on what was it, Terriers? Is that something you've seen?
No.
No? Okay. Feels like something worth seeing. At some point. I don't know anything about it, but yeah, she says here, I love Rian. He was the first director I ever watched work, so getting to see him work on that show was, oh my god, it was just a dream, Hedlund recalls. He was so kind and so quiet, and yet he was so clear about what he wanted. He never seemed stressed out, and I wish I was more like him. He's the he's like the patron saint of calm directors.
Wow. Nice. You know, I was just reading the Star Wars Archives book about the prequels the other day, and there was a similar quote about George in there, about how George creates such a George is always so calm and creates such a calm tone on set that it's very, like, welcoming, and people are happy going to work there and stuff like that. So,
And has a vision.
Yeah, well, he does have that. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that's something that's, you know, very, very true about both of them. And I think it's probably, like, just generally speaking, like, even outside of directing, like, it's easier to be calm when you know what's going on and when you have a vision for any task. And I think, you know, especially so in, you know, creative endeavors like this, when you're actually managing people. Like, I would say it's definitely the case for, like, teaching, when you know exactly what you're teaching, like, what content you want to deliver. It's, you know your management style, you know what to do. It's easy to be calm in front of a class, whereas, you know, when you're just getting started, when you get, like, or even being an experienced educator, like, when you get thrown through a loop or something and stuff starts unraveling and you don't have, or if you're not fully prepared for a lesson, you know, it's much harder to be calm.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. The next quote that you've pulled here is pretty compelling, about institutions and how we maybe should see the Jedi. That one reads, "The way I see Star Wars, the dynamics are either underdog versus institution or institutional threat, where it's father-son, sibling-sibling, master-apprentice, father-daughter. It's a familial dispute." So I would say that our show is more on the latter. It's more about individualized relationships. You're in the headspace of a lot of different characters. People who are good guys can be bad guys. People who are bad guys can be good guys. There's a lot of moral ambiguity, which is why Jodie Turner Smith's line in the trailer is so important. This isn't about good or bad. This is about power and who's allowed to use it. And I believe, of course, that the Jedi are benevolent, well-intentioned institution, but they are an institution and they have amassed all the power. So the question becomes, when did that happen? And since we know where they're headed in The Phantom Menace, what went wrong? What are the cracks in that? So you definitely get the point of view of the Jedi, especially in terms of a Mandalorian character and trying to stop her and hunt her down. But you also get enough of a Mandalorian character's perspective that you can also see how both of them exist simultaneously.
It's funny, this quote, because it starts with her saying, like, you know, Star Wars is typically, you know, people versus an institution, or it's like a family relationship, like, ours is the latter. And then she goes into, like, all this stuff about the institution and how that's, like, the core of the show is, you know, the Jedi Order as an institution. So I think, like, what she names here is, like, pretty spot on. Those, I think, just, like, any Star Wars story that comes to mind falls in these, like, categories that she names. But it does seem like, you know, I think the best Star Wars stories combine elements of all these. And I feel like, from what she's describing here, that's what The Acolyte is doing as well.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know, like, I'm sure that this is probably not exactly what the show is about or whatever, but, like, her discussion of institutions, for me, it feels like, you know, with the original Star Wars trilogy, you have this institution of the Empire, right? This massive, like, they're the opposite of benevolent. They're oppressive. They're selfish, whatever. But you have this massive institution, and then, this other perspective is to look at that and be like, wow, they have all the power and they need to be stopped or whatever. And obviously we sympathize with that perspective and the motivations behind it. And it almost sounds like she's describing, you know, in Amanda's character, something similar, but like the inverse of that or an inversion of that, where it's like, you know, looking at an institution, being like, I'm on the outside looking in, they have all the power, and feeling like that needs to be stopped. So a similar sort of, I don't know how to phrase it, like a similar kind of coming from a similar place, but like inverted, you know, the reversal of it almost. So that's pretty interesting. I think it's good to, happy to see her, hear her say like, well, they are benevolent and well-intentioned, but they're still an institution with a lot of power, because I don't think I would be super interested in a story from a storyteller who is like, you know, trying to do the whole like, well, what if the Empire are actually the good guys, you know, kind of story or whatever, which you do hear people say sometimes, which I think is like not smart. So I'm glad that it doesn't seem to be something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think this is something that George explored in the prequels. Like, part of it was what he was exploring is like the how the Jedi Order fell apart. But then you get Anakin Skywalker by the end of Revenge of the Sith, who's doing that, you know, exactly that bit that you were describing, where he's like, well, I think the Jedi are evil.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, but you know what you don't get, though, is you don't get, like, what she's describing here, like, you're in the headspace of a lot of different characters, and like, that feeling of from a person I know, or from people I know in the show, how do they feel about this institution of the Jedi or the Republic, and why it doesn't really work anymore. You don't get that. You know what I mean? You see Jedi, you see Palpatine, but you see very little of like what it feels like to be a citizen or somebody who lives in that galaxy and in that system. And you don't see, you get a little bit of that in the original trilogy, but I feel like you get very little of that in the prequels. And it's not really a criticism necessarily, but I don't think that's something that was explored very much. It was like, let's look at this from a political perspective, and you don't really look at it from a very personal perspective, except for from like people that are within it. You know what I mean? You've got like people that represent that institution of the Jedi and the Republic, and then you have like the mustache twirling bad guy, but you don't really get, you know, you don't see people who have genuine frustration with the Republic and try to understand why they might've been susceptible. The only person who we get that from is Anakin, and that's all about like Palpatine just manipulating him. So we don't really watch that and think, oh, well, yeah. So there was like, I mean, with the Jedi Order, we see some of the problems with it, but On a galactic or like a institutional level, I don't think we get a lot of that besides Anakin questioning the Jedi, I guess.
Yeah, I would say we get it with Ahsoka in the Clone Wars.
Mm-hmm.
She walks away.
Yeah.
And I think like on the inverse, we do get like occasional like sympathetic characters within the Empire who, you know, are like, well, you know, if I don't do this, and I know I'm doing these things that are bad, but if I don't, like, the galaxy will fall into chaos, because, like, you need someone to take care of things. And I think of, like, characters like Iden Versio or someone, and they eventually, like, end up, like, walking away, but I feel like that's been explored. Each of these things have been like explored slightly,
but not in the prequel movies. I'm talking about in the prequel movies themselves. Like, you don't see it in the prequel movies really, you know?
Yeah. But I think that's something like that we've been pushing towards in like the Disney era.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Well, we've got one, a quote here from or about Tony Gilroy. Andor creator Tony Gilroy proved that you don't necessarily have to be a lifelong Star Wars fan to be a great Star Wars storyteller. So I thought you made a wise choice by having a varied writer's room with fans of different eras and then someone who never flocked to it at all. So this is from the perspective of the writer of the piece, right? And then we have the response from Hedlund, who said, yeah, I just thought it would be good to have the perspective of a person that had literally never seen Star Wars until she was in the room. And she said to me, why do you want me in this room? I've never seen Star Wars. I have no idea. I think there's a dog in it, but I don't know anything. And I was like,
so much.
I was like, first of all, you're an incredible writer, but that's why I want you here. I want you to be questioning narrative. I don't want myself, who's a lifelong fan, to just be relying on particular references in order to create emotional beats. I want those emotional beats to be earned and checked by someone that isn't super familiar with it.
I love this so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think like there's so much I love about this, like this idea of like the writer's room with people who are first fans of different eras. I think, you know, a lot of the Star Wars that we get, and it's been getting better now, but I think we had like this very Star Wars from the perspective of like 40 to 50 year old white men, and like that was, you know, that was kind of it. So we were getting like a lot of like regurgitation of, you know, specifically, you know, original trilogy focus. And they were like kind of pandering to the same audience of, you know, people who were like them. And, you know, it kind of goes back to the J.J. Abrams like stressing like these are practical effects and like Jar Jar's bones are in the desert and, you know, like all of that stuff. And you get like hooting and hollering from, you know, a bunch of dude bros. But like that's a really like boring perspective when you get like 40 years of that like over and over again. And so I think like having, you know, people who, you know, what it sounds like is like there's people who are like prequels fans, like in the writer's room, people who are OT fans, people who maybe like started watching during the Disney era, like, you know, my boss at my job has the only Star Wars she's watched is The Mandalorian. That is the only Star Wars she cares to watch. She will not watch the movies. She will not watch Andor. Like, I insist on this. And she won't do it. She's like, this is the only thing I care about. And, you know, and I had not, like, really... And she knows, like, everything about The Mandalorian and is like super into like that story, those characters in particular, but that's it. Like, and I didn't kind of realize that there was that sort of Star Wars fan. Like, you know, I knew there are people who just like would watch the movie when it would come out, but you know, I've also met people who, you know, like younger than me, who's first exposure to Star Wars was the Clone Wars cartoon, and like that was like their Star Wars. So I think having all those perspectives is good to avoid this just like retreading that can happen with Star Wars, where it's just, you know, variations on a theme. And then I think it's also super interesting to have someone who's never seen it, like never seen it, but is just a good writer. And I love this line so much about, I don't want myself, who's a lifelong fan, to just be relying on particular references in order to create emotional beats. I want those emotional beats to be earned and checked by someone who isn't super familiar with it. Like, I think that is fantastic. And that is a shift from, you know, some of the Star Wars we've seen in the past decade or so.
Yeah. I think this response is great from her. Although honestly, like, to me, I think I'm responding almost more to, how do I put this? She seems like, listening to her talk, she seems to be as much of a fangirl as like Favreau or Filoni are fanboys, you know, or JJ Abrams. And so, like, I understand the problem that you're talking about with, like, you know, Star Wars just being a never ending cycle of like snake eating its own tail, referencing itself, and people just, you know, wanting to like regurgitate. I get all that. But like, I think really, to me, like, what's exciting about this is, you know, like, Rian Johnson 100% fits exactly into that category of, like, from a profile perspective, fits 100% into the category of the type of person you're talking about. And yet he didn't do that. And it's, to me, it's less about what did he grow up watching and what Star Wars was his Star Wars, and more just about having great instincts and great taste and being a really smart writer. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, a different person with exactly the same interests and background in Star Wars that Leslie Headland has would not get to the place that she gets to in this quote. So, yeah, it's cool that there's somebody in the room that hasn't seen Star Wars. But I think, to me, the most exciting part of this is just to hear her say things that really demonstrate that, you know, she's going to prioritize the right things. Because I think that's the best of both worlds, almost, you know, because you get somebody like Tony Gilroy. Like, obviously, Tony Gilroy doesn't give a shit about referencing emotional or referencing stuff from other Star Wars movies and then turning that into an emotional beat, right? Obviously, he doesn't care about that stuff. And that's part of why Andor is so awesome. But, you know, like, he could love Star Wars just as much as she does and still feel that way. You know what I mean? I guess is what this quote is demonstrating to me. So it's kind of cool that she does love all that stuff, but then on top of it, she's got her, I don't know, radar up or whatever to stop herself and the show from falling into that trap or whatever. So like, it almost sounds like an evolution of the Tony Gilroy thing, or like a better version of the Tony Gilroy thing, because she is going to stop herself from just doing that stuff, yet she also like really loves it. So I guess it's just a different, you know, branch of the same tree there, if that tree is like smart writers, you know. But
yes,
the most important thing is the trunk of that tree is that she's a smart writer. Tony Gilroy is a smart writer. Rian Johnson's a smart writer and director. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to make good choices. And I guess that's what I think is most important. And I'm a little less worried about, you know, well, in interviews, are you like, oh my God, in 1977, I was in line to see Star Wars and it blew my mind. Mm-hmm. Or Leslie Headland, in 1996, I was reading every EU novel. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's as scary as anything to me, you know? But she seems like she has great taste, and so she's going to make great choices.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think it kind of like goes back to something I saw. There was like a tweet or something being passed around a few years ago that's like always stuck with me, that someone was like, you know, when George Lucas, he made Star Wars, he was, you know, referencing his love of like war films and samurai films and Buck Rogers and all that, and now it just feels like Star Wars is referencing itself, mm-hmm. and is inspired by itself. And I think like the big takeaways I have when you look at people like Rian Johnson and Tony Gilroy and Leslie Headland here is like, they are bringing in influences outside of Star Wars and in like a meaningful way, whereas like, you know, like the Rashomon stuff in The Last Jedi isn't just like hey, this is a shot from that film that we're doing. It's like, no, this is like looking deeply at the storytelling and adapting that into Star Wars. And like, you know, Tony Gilroy, like, being like, this is not just like, you know, a line from the Manchurian Candidate or something. This is like, I'm looking deep into what makes like a spy thriller work, and, you know, adapting that to Star Wars. And I think, you know, the same thing with Leslie Headland, like, you know, what makes like wuxia action work, what makes, you know, what's the best part of like a murder mystery story, and then like how can that work into Star Wars. And it's not just like, you know, like, hey, here's another Death Star or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of the difference.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I think like this kind of brings me full circle on our whole or my whole response to this this trailer for The Acolyte, which is to say, like, I have a lot of faith in the project. I have a lot of faith in Leslie Headland and the cast, and, you know, I think there are just a lot of reasons to be excited for the show, and I think the trailer is very good, but, you know, it maybe didn't surprise me, or it didn't feel as different as I maybe thought that it would. So, yeah, you know, but that doesn't really hinder my excitement for the show. And, you know, I will be plenty happy if the show, you know, feels a lot like other Star Wars shows, but it's just like really well written and really, really well executed. It doesn't have to look super different to me. It doesn't have to be like, oh my God, I've never seen a Star Wars show like this, you know, because that's the thing about The Last Jedi, you know, if we want to use that as an example, it follows the template, the style guide of a Skywalker saga movie, you know, very closely. But it's done in such a smart way that it still feels fresh. And, you know, I don't think it looks particularly different from other Star Wars movies. I don't think stylistically it's particularly different from other Star Wars movies. I just think it's really, really smart and really, really well executed. And so, you know, the show still may end up feeling really different or looking really different or any of those things. And that's cool too. But, you know, even if it really does look and feel a lot like other Disney Plus Star Wars shows, I think as long as it's really smartly executed and a really compelling idea, which it seems like it will be, that that is going to be a-okay with me.
Yeah, I'm very, very hopeful, very, very excited for it. Also, it seems like, I don't know, like maybe this wasn't the perfect trailer for us, but it seems like it struck a chord with mainstream audience, because StarWars.com put up a post about how it set some new records for
a new record
for trailer views.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, which is wild to me, because I think like in my heart, like this still feels like a more, you know, indie feeling, like less mainstream approach to Star Wars. Like there's a lot of things that, you know, it doesn't seem to have like the same sort of like mainstream appeal as like The Mandalorian does, with like, you know, the triple punch of, you know, Pedro Pascal, like Boba Fett armor and Grogu. Like it doesn't, you know, those are the, you know, it's so like, is just so much mainstream appeal, whereas this is like, okay, well, this is set, you know, in the time period that, well, there's like 17 novels and 132 issues of comics that you can check out to learn more about the setting, and also it's like directly tied into those prequel movies that you hate, and like, you know, it's from you know, it's this like super diverse cast, and it's, you know, from the director of Russian Doll, which is the show you never watched, and like it just all of the like it doesn't seem like it would have, you know, that mainstream buzz, but and also like there is like this ongoing narrative that like, oh, Star Wars is on the decline. It's been on the decline since Solo. It's been on the decline since that last season of Mandalorian. It's, you know, been on the decline since Ahsoka was too woke, or you know, all this stuff. And like, but obviously, like, none of that is the case. Like, people are hungry for new Star Wars. People are hungry for really compelling, strange Star Wars with, you know, diverse casting creators. And I don't know, that just makes me very happy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely encouraging. And you know, the numbers on the trailer, and the show's gonna be coming out in the summertime. It's gonna be an exciting time to, you know, for people to see some new Star Wars, and hopefully it's gonna be well received and deserving of that reception. So I'm very excited. We gotta make our way through the final episodes of The Bad Batch here in the next 6 weeks or so, and that's gonna lead right. I think the last episode of the Bad Batch is on May 1st, rolling right into that May 4th weekend, and then, you know, a couple weeks out from this first episode. So it's going to be exciting times this spring and summer.
What are you doing on May 4th?
You know, there is the Skywalker Saga like marathon thing going on, and there's a theater, maybe, I don't know exactly where it is, Waukesha, I think it was, Wisconsin, probably like an hour from me or something like that, maybe a little more. And I talked to my family about it, and I thought they'd all be like, nah. But my wife and my son were both like, nah, yeah, that's cool. Let's do it. You know? And then I went to buy tickets, and they were sold out. So there was two showings around me, and they were sold out. So like, I guess it was, I didn't really think it would be something where you got to pull the trigger right away or you miss your shot. But yeah, that's what it is. That being said, even if I was going, the first movie, The Phantom Menace, starts at 8 p.m. on a Friday night. Like, realistically, I'd maybe see half of those movies, you know what I mean? Like, I'm 41 years old. I'm not going to be awake for 24 hours, especially starting on a Friday night. It's not happening. But I think it would have been fun to, like, go doze in and out and watch 9 Star Wars movies for close to 24. I mean, it would be crazy. But I'm not doing that. So I will be going to see The Phantom Menace that weekend, hopefully more than once. I have not bought tickets yet. I need to do that. I haven't bought tickets yet. I know you have your Alamo tickets, right, for Phantom Menace?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I got to get together with people and figure out what everybody wants to do. I want to go to Elgin. That's my favorite theater near us. So I want to go there and check it out. I'll hopefully go at least a couple times that weekend to The Phantom Menace, and that'll be my May 4th. What about you?
Yeah, got my Alamo tickets for The Phantom Menace.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing it first showing, 11 a.m. on May 4th.
Nice, nice.
So that's the first one that we have at Alamo. Very excited to see what they do for the pre-show.
Yeah,
they always cook up some good stuff, and then following the film, which I assume is the case for all of these screenings, is a special preview of The Acolytes.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. That is part of the Phantom Menace screenings across the board. Yeah. So that's going to be pretty sweet for sure.
That's great. Like, I think it'll be, I mean, it's not like I don't already know that movie front to back, but like, I think it will still feel like a good timely refresher.
Yeah.
You know, for The Acolyte, which, you know, because they are linked.
Right. Well, it's what they did with Rogue One, too. When Rogue One was re-released right before Andor, they had a special sneak peek at Andor, and they had actually a whole scene from Andor. They had some footage, like talking head, you know, people talking about the show or whatever, and then they showed a whole scene from, or a good chunk of a scene from the first episode of, actually, I think it was from the second or third episode of Andor, but it was the scene where he is in that like room and those things are falling down and
the warehouse.
Yeah. And Luthen is trying to get him to like, come on, let's leave the box. Let's go. You know, don't you want to, what does he say? What do you want to like, oh God, it's too well written for me to reproduce it here, but like,
yeah.
Don't you want to get those bastards for real or whatever? Like, don't you really want to have a shot at taking him out? So yeah, great scene. And that was cool. Okay, Ryan, you, as I understand it, recently traveled to Beantown, to Boston. Mm. Is that right?
It's true. Yep.
Yeah. PAX East, is that correct?
PAX East, the Penny Arcade Expo Eastward.
Eastward, okay.
Eastbound.
East. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, cool. So, did you come across any Star Wars content while you were out there at PAX East?
I sure did.
Oh, wow.
So at the convention, so if you're not familiar with PAX, it is a video game / tabletop game convention. And I'd never been to a PAX before, and I went to this one because I was on spring break and my wife was working at it, so I just flew out. She was already out there, and I think like what surprised me, because I'd always thought of PAX mostly as like a video game thing, but it really is about maybe like 60-40 in terms of video games versus the tabletop gaming stuff. There's a lot of like tables set up, like a lot of tables set up for tabletop gaming. And then there's, you know, a lot of booths of vendors selling their games, but also like a lot of like creators of tabletop gaming and stuff there. And one of the booths, the one that caught my eye, was like, it was a whole area, really, and that was Fantasy Flight Games, and their booth for Star Wars Unlimited, which is a new collectible card game from them. It is not the first Star Wars collectible card game. I think you may remember back in the mid-90s during the big Star Wars resurgence, where we were getting, you know, the EU was coming into its own, and you know, the figures, Power of the Force figures were happening, THX versions of the movies, like all that, like when Star Wars was coming back, I remember coming across a Star Wars collectible card game, and the cards had just like still shots from the films in it. Mm-hmm. And I believe that card game is from 1995. And what's super interesting about that card game that I just learned literally over the weekend when I was trying to like remember stuff about it, was it was actually the next game created by the creator of Magic the Gathering.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
So okay. that was what he did next after, you know, just in case the whole Magic the Gathering thing didn't work out. Yeah, so that's super interesting. But that was a card game, like, I remember, you know, I would get, like, a card or two, like, polybagged in, like, issues of, like, Wizard Magazine and stuff. It was a pretty big deal. And then apparently there was a card game, which I'm not familiar with, that came out in 2002, that was really well received, from Wizards of the Coast, and, people still play it today, and, like, people still maintain, like, fan communities and, like, make new cards that you can, like, print up and stuff, and still have tournaments, so... that was interesting learning about, but this is the first, like, big Star Wars customizable card game, you know, of kind of this era.
Right.
You know, it's been a minute, and, you know, Fantasy Flight Games is a huge, board gaming and collectible card game company. So this is a pretty big deal. Outside of the convention center, there was like big LCD displays, like advertising it. Yeah, it's a big thing. The game actually launched, earlier in the month. All the vendors at PAX were sold out of it. I don't know, like, I'm sure you can go on eBay or go to your local hobby shop, maybe even Amazon. I didn't really look online, to get it, but basically the game just launched, and the first, you know, the first series of it is called Spark of Rebellion, and it is primarily, original trilogy based cards. So yeah, that's kind of the overview. But I actually had a chance to, play a demo game of it, with, you know, an employee of Fantasy Flight Games, which was something, you know, they were doing there, offering these free demos, to let people check out the game. And so I did, and I played like about a half hour long game. And so a few takeaways for me were, It's an interesting setup where the primary objective is to destroy your opponent's base. They have a base card that has a bunch of hit points, and you want to, like, whittle that away. And you do that through, you have kind of two main categories that you're, like, setting your cards out in. You have space, which is one side, and then ground units is another side. So, like, your X-Wings and stuff go in the space side, your opponent's TIE fighters go there, your, you know, rebel troopers go on the ground side, your opponent's stormtroopers go on their ground side, and basically, like, your units are there to attack the other person's base, but also deflect damage when, you know, they're trying to attack your base and vice versa. So there's a lot of kind of things in play at any time. And so And, you know, the cards can, like, power each other up. You can get separate cards that affect the stats on the card. And so there's, like, a lot of kind of, like, four-dimensional chess happening because you have so many different factors at play. And so you really have to keep track of a lot because you are essentially fighting a war on multiple fronts. But it becomes pretty intuitive. Like, you're doing a lot per turn. But I, you know, eventually, like, the game I played probably took 20 to 30 minutes. And, you know, it was a lot of him, like, showing me the ropes, and, it wasn't, like, a huge, strategic conflict, or anything where I think, like, the games could potentially go longer. I don't really know how long an average game will take for seasoned players, but I think, like, by the end of it, I had kind of gotten a feel for the cadence of the game. And, you know, I could kind of, like, appreciate the mechanics, even though, like, I wasn't quite able to wrap my head around, like, what would be a, like, quote-unquote good strategy. Like, I would not even know where to start if I was putting together a deck by myself. Like, I would not know how many cards of each type to put in there. I wouldn't really know, like, when to play what kind of thing, and when to hold things, and all of that. So, but I did get, like, I played enough to get, like, a feel for the game, essentially.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
I've been reading a little bit about it on the site, which is StarWarsUnlimited.com. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I sort of understand what I'm reading, but yeah. I've never played a collectible card game. Or is that what this is? A collectible card game? Yeah, never played one. So it's slightly, you know, some of the jargon is not super familiar to me. Mm-hmm. It says here, the most common way of playing Star Wars Unlimited is to build a deck using cards from your own collection, test your skills against other players, and with a player count of 2, the time per game would be about 20 minutes.
Okay.
But then there's other types of play that are listed here, like draft play and sealed play.
Oh, yeah.
Which, that's, like, more for tournaments and stuff, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's when you go to your local comic or hobby shop and you know, you pay your $25 and they give you a deck right there on the spot and you play against other people.
Yeah, so those say they would take, like, more like 2 to 3 hours to play. So, yeah, but more people playing and all that kind of stuff, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks cool. Like, I also was looking at the cards. It does seem OT focused, I guess, for sure.
Yeah.
But there's, like, Jyn Erso and, you know, some characters from, like, newer, like, from Clone Wars and Rebels and stuff like that too, in there. So there are some characters outside of the, Count Dooku, I see, listed there. Of course. Yeah. So, there's a little bit of stuff from other eras, but yeah, I guess you're right that it's mostly OT. How did you feel about the card art, Ryan?
It seems
hit or miss to me.
Yes.
Some seems better than others.
That's what I was feeling as I was playing. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't have a ton of TCG experience. The game I've played the most is the Pokemon card game.
Of course.
I played that as in my teenage years, and then, you know, my wife and I went through a phase where we played just basically with each other for like about a year or so, and played through a few different sets there. I've dabbled in magic. We have this this like wrestling card game that that my wife got that features a bunch of like wrestlers from the indies. Mm-hmm. And I can't even remember what it's called, but like we have like Matt Cardona cards and stuff, which is pretty fun. But yeah, but one thing that I'd picked up recently, cause I was just curious about it, was the Disney Lorcana, card game, which, mm-hmm. recently released. And something with that game is we picked up a few, starter decks and booster packs. We haven't actually played, my wife and I, but, the art is amazing. Like the art on every card is just stunning. And it's like, even if like we don't end up ever playing the game, like it's cool to just like have these cards to look at, cause they look awesome. And I feel like generally speaking, like the Pokemon card game, like it looks like Pokemon. It's like colorful and cute and, you know, does the job. Magic has just wildly intricate, like top of the line fantasy art there. Mm-hmm. That's like, wow, any of these cards, like you could like frame and like hang up if you had like a print of them, kind of thing. And I don't feel that way about Star Wars Unlimited. Everything like looks on brand, but it reminds me of some of like the like kind of like B tier Star Wars comics.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, stuff you'd maybe get in like a children's book kind of thing, where it's like, yeah, these are not like your Phil Noto's and your like top Star Wars artists here. Yeah. And, you know, I think it's like, you know, you could say like the art is whatever. It's, you know, it's all about the game and the strategy, and who cares what the picture is on the card. It's, you know, what the text is and everything. But I think it's also worth noting these cards are expensive as hell. Like,
yeah,
like, I mean, just like a starter deck is like $20. You need two of those. You're going to need booster packs, which are like $5 to $10 a piece. You know, if you really want to like hone your deck, you're gonna have to buy cards individually, and you know, cards can run from, you know, $5 to hundreds of dollars. Like, you're spending, you know, if you're really getting into this and buying into this, you're spending a lot of money. So I think it's like fair to want really good art on the cards. Like, I think of, you know, magic cards in particular, which range in tens of thousands of dollars, and
yeah,
but they do feel like they have this like really premium, like high quality, like artistic feel, where you're like, yeah, I guess that card's worth $5,000. I don't know. And they really just, they feel, you know, epic and, you know, really classical, like painterly, just, you know, super high quality, essentially.
Yeah.
Whereas like these cards don't have that feeling. They don't have a premium feel in the art, and that's a bummer. And I think, you know, I think after finishing, like, my demo game, like, based on the gameplay itself, like, I could have gone either way and, like, you know, maybe dropped $100 and got some decks and some booster packs and been, like, really excited about it. But I do think the art is kind of what held me back. And even just the design of the cards feels, I don't know, just the overall graphic design just doesn't feel premium to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess you can't expect a consistent look when all of the cards are, like, commissioned, drawn art like this, because you're not going to have one artist doing all the cards, right? It would be too much, but I think some of them look pretty nice, and then there's some other ones that, like, look not good at all to me, so, you know, that is what it is. But I will just say, part of it's nostalgia, too. I never played the CCG from the 90s at all. I had some friends, like some of our friends and some of my friends in high school played it. I did not. And I was just looking at some of those cards on eBay and stuff and like kind of like, oh man, I kind of want to buy some of those old, you know, like those ones. And I just don't know that I would feel that way about these cards because they just don't have like, I don't know. There's not nothing super special about the look here that would excite me. It and like reading about how you play the game and listening to you talk about how you play the game, it doesn't really seem like it would skew towards kids, but some of the art and like even the graphic design of it overall kind of, it does seem like it looks more like it would be for a younger audience. That's the feel I get from the look of it.
Yeah, I think it would be. And this is just anecdotal, because I know, you know, it's such a thing for, you know, kids to want Pokemon cards and then not be able to play the game. Like they're like kids, you know, from, you know, elementary school to middle school, you know, and will collect Pokemon cards and want them, but like never play the game and not really understand or have the patience for it when given the opportunity. Like, obviously that is not the case for all kids, but just generally speaking, as being someone who, you know, works in schools and, you know, has a lot of friends whose kids end up having like geeky interests. Like that is the reoccurring story. And I would say this game is significantly more complex than the Pokemon trading card game. So I do think there is a disconnect with like, cause I don't think, you know, I don't think kids are playing this game. Like I could not see kids going into like hobby shops and, you know, collecting these cards and wanting to play the game. Like obviously there's going to be some. I'd posted about it on Blue Sky and someone was like, yeah, I've been playing this with my son. Like obviously there are cases, but this is not going to break through the mainstream in the same way that Pokemon trading card game has. And even then, the amount of, like, kids who actually play the game is pretty low. So I don't really understand why they went with this, like, overall art style. Like, yeah, there's, like, variation between, but there's just, like, this, the overall look. I think even just, like, the borders around the cards has this kind of just like cheap and generic feel that doesn't quite feel like a top quality Star Wars product.
Yep.
And you know, that is just like aesthetic, and that could even change on the next, you know, the next set of cards. And You know, who knows? But as of right now, it's not like I enjoyed playing the game. But it's not something I think I will be investing money in.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it definitely looks cool. There's a lot there, that's interesting, including, you know, bringing in different eras of Star Wars and animated characters and movie characters and TV show characters. Mm-hmm. Although I don't know if there's any TV show characters, but yeah, you know what I mean? That kind of stuff. And obviously there's the opportunity for more of that going forward, right? Cause this is just the first, I don't know what you call it, like first set or first mm-hmm. series or, you know, whatever. So, yeah, I mean, it seems cool. I, you know, like I said already, I've never even played a game like this, so I'm not exactly the audience for it, but, It does look pretty interesting. And I guess, you know, what we've been talking about, like the complexity of it or like the difficulty of it or whatever, that's probably a draw for a lot of people, right? Like if you're going to invest all this money in the game, you don't want it to be something, you know, like simple and that you're going to master in right away or whatever, right? So for the sake of the longevity of the game, it's probably good that there's a level of complexity to it too, right?
Yeah, I think like something I was just kind of like wondering when I was at PAX is like they had, you know, in the gaming area, they had tables set up where people were playing Magic. Funny story. So Larian Games, their European developer, they made the Divinity games, and most recently they made Baldur's Gate 3. Which, you know, racked up tons of like Game of the Year awards and stuff last year. It's a phenomenal game. They had a huge booth. It was literally a castle. And so they had a massive presence. It was the first thing you saw when you like walked into the show floor. It was awesome. But Lindsay was telling me that when she would come in 2 or 3 hours before the show opened every day. I only did that on one of the days, but she was telling me that when she would get there, you know, 2 hours before the show would open, all of the Larian staff were there at their booth at the tables playing Magic with each other every morning. They would have like a morning games of Magic. Which is just kind of like a fun story. But I was thinking about that when I was like walking around the show floor. Like they have these tables like, okay, this is where people are playing Lorcana. This is where people are playing Magic. And I was kind of like wondering, because there's also like an area for Pokemon. But I was wondering like, because there are people selling all different kinds of collectible card games. And I'm just like wondering, it's such like a huge commitment and investment to get into this stuff. And a lot of times, like, you know, like I think Pokemon and Magic are like the games that are just like eternal. Mm-hmm. But, like, everything else just kind of seems to, like, come and go. And it's always like, well, you know, Disney's doing their game now. Like, you know, hope for the best. Yeah. And people are, like, have to make this hard decision. Like, do I spend, you know, hundreds of dollars on this thing, like, at launch? Because, like, if I don't, these cards are going to go out of print. And then they're going to be thousands of dollars, you know, in a couple of years from now, and like all this stuff. And I just wonder, it does feel like such a niche thing. Like, I wonder how many of these card games the market can support.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I wonder that with like the Disney Lorcana, and I really wonder with this like Star Wars game, like, can, you know, are there enough people who are, you know, Star Wars fans that also like collectible card games that are going to be willing to like buy into this, you know, and make it sustainable for, you know, a decade? Or is it going to be the case of, you know, the previous Star Wars collectible card games that last, you know, a couple of years, and then they just stop making them and people stop playing them, and, you know, there's not, you know, not official tournaments by the companies anymore and stuff. So I do wonder, like, I think it'll be interesting to kind of see, because it seems like for most people, you probably can't afford to invest in more than one of these games for, like, a lifetime, essentially, sure. You know. So,
yeah.
I wish them the best. Like, people were at the booth were nice, and it's a good game. It doesn't have a ton of appeal to me, but, you know, be interesting to see how it plays out.
Cool. Any other Star Wars stuff at PAX, or was that the primary thing?
I did make a purchase from the Limited Run booth. I bought the Switch version of The Force Unleashed the special THX VHS packaging, which is a convention exclusive, and you know, could not pass that up. So I did buy that, and I played it a little bit. It's a really interesting game, because it's the Switch HD version of the Wii version of the game, which is a unique game compared to like the PC and Xbox 360 and PS3 version of the game. So it is like, it is an upscaled 16:9 version of the Wii game, for better or worse. And you can use the Joy-Con for the motion controls and everything. So it's a unique game. It's available far cheaper to just like buy it digitally on the eShop versus this ridiculous edition that I bought. But it's a cool thing to have in the collection. But I think that was about it for Star Wars at PAX.
Cool. All righty. Well, we better wrap the show up there, Ryan. So, you know, thanks so much for listening or watching. We'll be back soon with another episode of the podcast sometime in April. And, you know, until then, you can find everything we've done at blockaderunnerpodcast.com. If you want to message the show, you can email us, blockaderunnerpodcast@gmail.com, or follow the show on Blue Sky. Follow Ryan on Blue Sky at
Standard Definition Gaming.
Okay. All right. Very good. So yeah, thanks. Thanks again for watching or listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Blockade Runner podcast.